Good afternoon. So last time we talked about virtualized operators besides shifts. So shifts were the notion that we had a value which in the processor probably we just have a bunch of wires with each bit and we could select a particular bits easily in hardware by just ignoring the other wires. And we also wanted ways to do operations to particular bits. And the way we exposed that were these bitwise operators where we did the same thing to each pair of bits between two values. We exposed leaving gates, our building blocks of our processor that way. We saw bitwise AND, OR, and XOR. And then we talked about ways of using this to solve sort of problems which aren't so straightforward that involve manipulating bits. We went through the example of the ternary operator, the if X, then YLC. And doing that without our traditional conditionals and what that looked like. Talked about this divide and conquer strategy of finding these subproblems, the things we could OR together to get our answer, and doing work in parallel, we saw, for seeing if any bit is set, like not doing 64 ORs, but taking advantage of the fact that each of these bitwise operation does a lot of things in parallel, and we can take advantage of not just one bit of the answer, but a lot of the bits of the answer. So any questions on things we talked about last time? Okay, so a brief logistical note. There's a post quiz that will be released tonight. It's labeled 6 p.m., so I have enough time to make sure it doesn't cover things we didn't talk about in lecture. And a pre-quiz that will be released again, just reminding you since this is the first time, and people will forget. So, to finish up talking about bit manipulation, there are often bit manipulation instructions that C doesn't expose. So C exposes these bitwise operators and shifts, but processors often have other things, and a lot of these exist because we discovered that they're not really easy to do with the existing bitwise operators. So, or alternately, like they're really easy to implement in hardware. So there's rotate, which is like shifting, but it wraps around. So instead of shifting in zeros, we shift things from that get shifted off, move to the top of the number. This turns out to be pretty, simple to have some piece of hardware which does a shift OR rotate, and you just change what values get shifted in. First or last bit set. So a common thing you might want to do is figure out, you have a bit for every value in like an array, you want to know where the first array element is occupied. That's a common operation. You can do that with bitwise operators, but it's pretty annoying. You imagine that you have to if you're not doing something clever, you check 64 places to see which bit is set first, potentially. And if you're doing something more clever, you can be faster, but it's still like a bunch of operations to find the first bit that's set. So a lot of processors have decided that this is a useful instruction to provide because in hardware, you can make hardware that looks kind of like what you might imagine checking for something as zero is that does this operation much faster. And related to that, another common operation is population count, or just count the number of bits set in a value. That's another thing which you can make hardware to do really fast, but it's tricky to do with our bitwise operators. Yes?
So wait, VSF, VSR, is VSF the first bit set? And then what is VSR?
I don't actually remember which is which.
Why would one of them be R instead of like L for last?
Why would they be R instead of L? Because I don't know. I think it's bit scan forward and bit scan reverse, but I'm not actually sure because I don't use these instructions. Another common example is byte swap. So that's like changing a number from big to little endian or vice versa. Very easy to make hardware doing that. You can do it with shifts, but it takes, several of them. So some processors have decided to provide an instruction to make that more efficient. So speaking of instruction set choices, let's talk about instruction sets. So we're first going to define what instruction sets are. But you've seen what we call these instruction set architectures. So x86 is one that you've definitely heard of because you know x86 assembly. And there's a whole bunch of others that are still being made, being developed. Besides x86, probably the most notable one today is ARM, which is the most common type of processor in things like mobile phones and the embedded devices. There's a few others. So there's Power, which was used in the Wii U's, and IBM still uses it, that same architecture in their supercomputers and some servers they sell for a lot of money. We have MIPS, which our textbook talked about a bunch when they were talking about RISC. This was one of the architectures that was developed when RISC was being created, and sort of the canonical example of RISC, which we'll talk about later. And it exists today. If you look at many Wi-Fi access points, some of them use ARM, some of them use MIPS. It's probably about even-ish. There's Spark. If you knew about the Sun Microsystems, when that was a company that wasn't bought by Oracle, this was their main architecture, and Oracle still makes machines with this architecture, and some other companies do too. There's Z architecture, which is IBM's name for their mainframe architecture, which has contiguous lineage back to the 60s when they made it, 60s, 70s. They just still make those machines, just with more modern techniques. We have the Z80, so if you've used a TI calculator, TI-83, it has a Z80 processor, which is an instruction set, and it's the same processor design that's been made for many years, apparently. Just no reason to change. And there's a bunch of others. The Shark, which is used for some signal processors like audio, video processing, specialized instruction set for that. And RISC-V would be the instruction set that if I were choosing the curriculum we'd be using. It's a recent set instruction set which seems to be getting some play in the embedded space. It was developed by academics at Berkeley. So we have all these instruction sets, and a good question is, like, why are there so many? Like, people clearly have been dissatisfied with the other instruction sets because they didn't just decide, yeah, x86 is good enough, I'm going to use that, or MIPS is good enough, I'm going to use that. They made different choices. So we're going to talk about a bunch of the choices these instruction sets make, so we can start thinking about, like, what's good or bad. But to talk about that, we first need to talk about what's part of the instruction set architecture and what isn't. And there's going to be two things we'll talk about there. There's the instruction set. That's what's in the instruction set architecture, and that's the interface software sees. It's your assembly language. It's your binary formats. It's what matters for software compatibility. Can I run on this hardware? That's determined by what instruction set does the hardware implement. That's separate from the question of the microarchitecture or the design of the hardware. So for example, Intel chips called Xeon or Core i3, i5, i7 have these generations. And each of those generations is a different microarchitecture. It's a different hardware design. It implements the same instruction set. They're compatible chips in that sense. But they have different hardware implementations for that same interface. And they have differences in performance and efficiency. So different older Intel chips, you know, have this different design, so they have different performance. And these might just not be that we can do better than we did before. These might be like, I want a different kind of chip for my laptop than my desktop because I care about power more on my laptop than my desktop. So you might have a different microarchitecture to take advantage of that. Yes?
So on different
microarchitectures, is it possible that instructions have different times? Or do they based on cycles, or how do we know? So the question is how long instructions take part of the microarchitecture? And the answer is yes. So different microarchitectures will have different efficiency. So the software compatibility is about compatibility, but you will see differences in performance and efficiency between different implementations of an instruction set. Because that's not part of the the specification of the instruction set. The instruction set tells you this is our assembly, this is what how it translates to machine code, this is how the processor is going to run it. It doesn't tell you the add takes twice as long as the multiply. It tells you there's an add, it works, there's a multiply, it works. It doesn't tell you which one's faster, if you know, if one's really, really slow or whatever. Yeah.
So do each of the different instruction sets, like on the previous slide, do they all have their own assembly?
So the question, do each of these instruction sets have their own assembly? There's usually, you can have multiple assembly languages for one instruction set. We see that with x86, like AT&T versus Intel syntax. You might consider those different assemblies. They typically have a canonical assembly, and they definitely have the machine code is like what matters for the hardware, right? So they have the same, they have a specified binary format, and some assembly language that goes to that.
But do they have the same registers?
Question is, do they have the same registers? So the question is basically like, how do ISAs vary?
Yeah.
So we're going to go over a bunch of ways they vary. So there's lots of choices made. But we're going to start with the highest level choices, which include what registers do they have? How big are instructions in machine code? And how many instructions do we provide? And these are like some of the easiest things to observe about ISAs. So I just have a table here for a bunch of ISAs, some of which were on my list of ones being made today and some of which aren't. So I have the length of an instruction in machine code. And you can see that we have these two big camps. We have variable length instruction set ISAs like x86 and z80 and VAX and IBM mainframes. And we have fixed length ones like ARM, Power, MIPS, Itanium, and RISC-V. So the ones with variable length have made a choice that we want short, simple instructions to take up less space. The other ones have made a choice that we want it to be easy to figure out where instructions are, so they're going to be all the same. Yeah?
What do the asterisks mean by like?
So what are the asterisks? So in some cases, defining what instruction length is a bit complicated. So in the case of ARM, normal ARM instructions are 4 bytes. There is, however, some features that some ARM processor supports which have different lengths. For RISC-V, the same thing is true. Their normal RISC-V instructions are 4 bytes. There are features some RISC-V processor supports which support different length instructions. And for Itanium, obviously something weird's going on to make 41-bit instructions because it's a byte addressable memory. So there's some notion of instructions come in groups. And the instruction part of the group is 41 bits, but there's some other information there. And we won't talk too much about that. You can look it up. It's Itanium's a very weird architecture, as you can see it by it being an outlier on the first two columns of this table. So this is our instruction length, yeah. And there are exceptions, is like this is not as straightforward as you'd like because many of these architectures are pretty complicated. So then I have here the number of normal registers, I mean like registers that you can use for like normal integer addition, that sort of thing. Sometimes like this involves some judgment calls to count. So if we think of x86, for example, x86 has floating point registers. But and 64-bit x86, and you can also store integers in them and sometimes do integer math in them. I didn't count those, but you could argue they're registers. So there's some fuzziness as far as the register count. But I give in probably the most canonical number for each one, and we can see we have sort of different choices. We have some things with very few registers, some with a lot of registers. Or this is one of the choices you make when you design your instruction set. Yes?
Is there like a rhyme or reason to why they're named the way they are with like the numbers and stuff?
Why?
Represent something?
Oh, the number, and why, so the question is there a reason for the instruction sets to be named the way they are? I'm sure there's a story behind all of them, but they're all different. And, you know, I don't know the details. In the case of ARMv7 and Power8, the 7 and 8 are version numbers, basically. So there was a power 1, 2, 3, and so on. Yeah?
So what's bad about having more registers? why wouldn't you want more registers?
The question is, why wouldn't you want more registers? So there are two disadvantages with more registers. So one is the processor needs to implement them. So if you wanted to like get it up to a million, you need to want to implement a million registers, that's probably not going to be very fast. Because you can't really store a million things very fast. It's, you know, going to take up a lot of space. So at some point, you know, it's too much. Another thing is that you have to put information about what register you're accessing in the instruction. So it takes up space there. And if you're concerned about having your instructions be short, that's a problem. And I guess alongside like the space needed for the registers, if it turns out that most of the time programs aren't using most of those registers, like you just wasted space in your processor that could have been used for something else. And like that might be something you might imagine being concerned about with like the Itanium's choice, like how many of the programs you write will actually use 100 registers. Yeah, that's a hard thing to hard thing to imagine happening that often.
Well, I imagine it's not 4B though.
The Itanium?
Yeah.
So the Itanium was targeting normal server systems. They just decided to have a lot of registers. And their notion was compilers could figure out how to take advantage of it. Yes, the question was like variable length means we're saving space versus fixed length means it's easier to fetch. Yes, that's exactly the big trade-off between the two. Okay. So the other thing I have here is the approximate number of instructions. So this is approximate because counting instructions is tricky. Like for example, you know, is add L and add Q, are those different instructions? You know, 64-bit versus 32-bit add, are they different instructions? Depends who you ask. So I made some judgment calls in counting this, so don't look too carefully at the numbers. But we can see we have this variation. We have some really simple instruction sets from this metric, like Z80 has 40 instructions. And we have things like x86, which is like 1,500 instructions. Power, yeah.
So what's going on in Y86-64 when we've got 10 byte instructions and there are only 18 of them?
We'll see later. Y86-64 is a simplified version of x86 we'll be using. So we'll see later.
This is the thing from the textbook.
It's the one from the textbook, okay. Which you hopefully read about.
Okay.
So the bytes of instructions, because we have the instructions in Y86 are 10 bytes, because we need to fit an 8-byte thing in them. That's why we need 10 bytes.
Okay.
And similar is generally true for like x86. Like x86, the 15-byte instructions are probably the sort of instructions where we have like an 8-byte value in the middle of them somewhere, or something like that. And I guess a notable limitation of that is if you think about that, this means that a disadvantage of not having variable length instructions is that something like RISC-V with 4-byte instructions, if you want to fit an 8-byte value in the instruction, you can't. So they can't have those instructions. You have to do something else. Okay, so these are probably the highest level choices where you know, different instruction sets choose different compromises as far as, you know, how complicated their encoding is, how many registers they let programmers use. I should say these are normal registers. These are registers you can name in assembly and do normal arithmetic with. There are more registers. We learned about the condition codes as extra registers. And there are lots of registers and processors to implement instructions that you might never see in assembly, depending on the microarchitecture again. And we have different counts for instructions, which a lot has to do with history. Like x86 is based on a much simpler instruction set. They didn't start making an instruction set and say, yeah, we're going to have, we need all these 1500 instructions. That's not what happens. You know, that happened over time, and that's generally true for all the others on this list. Yeah. So question, are all these instruction sets Turing complete? Absolutely. You can compute anything on all these types of machines, provided you have enough memory. Okay, so there's some other choices in instruction sets. So one is about condition codes. So you've seen x86, where we have this notion of a separate compare and conditional jump instruction. And this is not what everyone does. So for example, on some other instruction sets like MIPS, they don't have condition codes. Instead, they have a instruction like branch if equal, that it does a comparison, and based on that, does a conditional jump. So it's these combined into one instruction, rather than having condition codes at all. This is a design choice, so we're simplifying things in the sense that we don't have condition codes, but we're making things more complicated in the sense that now we need to make separate comparison instructions rather than sort of getting it for free from our subtract. So another big choice is what the operands to instructions are. So we talked about registers, but we know in x86, like, you can add to a memory location, you can specify that memory location in a whole bunch of ways, you can add a constant. So the choices about what types of operands we can specify, and these are called addressing modes, the ways we can specify operands for instructions. And we've seen that x86 is actually really generous with the number of addressing modes it provides, because we have this general format and all the simplifications of it, and we can specify, you know, constants as an additional way we can specify operands, and, you know, there's actually a few more. So we have all these different addressing modes in x86, and other architectures might choose other ways you can specify operands. So for example, on ARM, for many instructions, you can supply one of the operands as a register shifted over by some amount. Just like you can specify a memory location, like you can say add R3 and R11 shifted over by 2 or 3 or 1. Like, that's a form of the add instruction. And lots of other instructions you can specify that. On VAX, which was an old ISA that we'll talk more about because it was very historically important, you could specify your operand was, you had a register in which we'd look up a contain a memory address, we'd look up that location in memory and use that value we looked up in memory as a memory address to look up again to find our final value. So this would be like a double pointer indirection as an assembly instruction operand. So you'd be like, you could do add double parentheses R11, like dereference R11 twice to load your value for the add. So these are choices for the instruction sets, and we have this compromise here that if we have more addressing modes, it might be more convenient, might let us do things more compactly, but obviously someone's doing more work to implement that. And when we make addressing modes, we're doing it because we think that these are convenient things. So x86 has, for example, this index and scale because we think that's really a useful thing to do for accessing arrays. That's why they designed it that way. And ARM doing this shifting is making another judgment that it's useful to be able to shift over to multiply by like 1, 2, 4, and 8 lots of times, so we'll make that part of the instruction. Okay, so questions on addressing modes? Okay. So another big choice that instruction sets make is how many operands instructions have. So we've seen x86, where we have a source, and one of those sources is also the destination. So we have this source-destination notion, and this is, you know, a reasonable choice. Another thing you could do is you can have two sources and a separate destination register. So I can add from the two registers together and put the result in a third register without modifying one of the original two registers. Whereas if I want to do that in x86, I need to do a move and then an add. So it's not that these are less capable, but this is a choice. But the disadvantage of doing the first form is now we need to have our machine code contain information about three registers and not two. So it makes our machine code less compact. And VACs, that historically important instruction set, its choice in this space is to support both. Okay. So that's one big choice, you know, that affects every part of the instruction set. And our big choice, as we saw indirectly here with the number of instructions, is sort of what the complexity of the instructions are. So for example, x86 has a bunch of instructions that might write multiple values. So like push and pop, push writes the stack pointer into memory. It writes two values as a side effect. Pop writes the stack pointer and the register you're popping into. So it writes two values as part of its side effect. And some ISAs have deliberately chosen not to have any instructions that work that way. That's too complicated, we're not going to do it. You know, and there's other forms of complexity, and we'll see them a bit later. But so this is one big choice, is like, do I want to have complicated instructions? The advantage, of course, is that if you're an assembly programmer, push is nice and convenient. The disadvantage is that it's going to be harder to implement in our hardware. It's going to make our hardware more complicated and maybe slower to support that instruction well. And this instruction set complexity gets us to something we had you read about RISC, which stands for Reduced Instruction Set Computer. So it's reduced. So what is it reduced from? And we have this contrasting notion of a complex instruction set computer. And our textbook talks about sort of typical attributes of RISC and mentions sort of the genesis of it being this project from Stanford, parallel project from Berkeley, that were building these particular ISAs that had a very different philosophy. I think a better way of understanding of like what was going on is to look at the canonical example of a complex instruction set computer. This is what they were specifically not doing, and that's VACs. And VACs, you know, we think of x86 of having these complicated instructions like push and pop and move s is like copy from one memory location to the other and increment a counter, you know, sort of instructions. You know, x86 has some complicated instructions, but you know, that wasn't like exactly what the canonical example of a CISC machine was. So here are some real VACs instructions. I'll give you a minute to read over these descriptions with their assembly syntax and the like short description of what they do. So we have match C, which is string in string, and it takes a length, so this can read an arbitrarily large amount of memory to find a string in another string. We have evaluate a polynomial, which takes the length of the polynomial and does, you know, that number of multiplications and additions. And we have edit PC, which is basically something kind of like printf, but in an instruction. So these were real max instructions. And you might say, gosh, this looks hard to implement in hardware. What the heck were they doing? Why was this something they did? So let's talk first about like how does a hardware implementation of this look like? Now, we haven't talked much about hardware yet. So I'm going to give you the very high-level overview. So the basic implementation that typical VAX machines used is that they had a lookup table for what they called microcode, where basically the machine translated these instructions into a different, simpler instruction set that actually ran on the hardware, which interpreted the machine code. And that's how they could do things like these instructions which access an arbitrary amount of memory and have these things like loops, is that there was this lookup table for microcode that actually implemented this, and that's really what happened on the machine, is that it found the instruction, it looked up in this lookup table what to do next. So you basically had a little simpler instruction set that implemented these complex instructions. So that's what they were doing at the time. And you might say, like, why were they, in the 70s and 80s, like, why were they making instructions like this? Why were they doing this? And a big difference at the time is that they were expecting people to write assembly. That people didn't really trust compilers very much, and for good reason, compilers weren't very good. And they often wrote assembly, so they made their machines support writing assembly really well by implementing these things that you'd expect to be library functions as instructions. And sort of all the instructions were implemented this way, so some of them, would translate to something very simple or basically be a null translation, and some wouldn't. But a consequence of this is that we have some code which implements this match C. Would it implement the best string comparison algorithm? Hopefully, but maybe not. And this meant that there were two things about having this as an instruction versus not. That with this implementation technique, the gain you were getting about having this as an instruction versus implementing the string, string and string operation yourself with a loop, was just that you were fetching less instructions. But as far as the underlying operations, it's basically the same thing would happen after the lookups as if you wrote the loop yourself. Because we translate to this microcode, it would be almost the same stuff. And this meant that this instruction was not necessarily much faster than the string and string that you would implement yourself with a loop if you were good. And sometimes it might be slower because maybe they didn't write the best algorithm in their microcode. And implementing these instructions is tricky. That now, if I'm building a VAX machine and I want to make sure everything works before I send it out the door, I need to write test cases for all these things, and make sure that those instructions work as expected. That's a lot harder than if my list of things to test was add, subtract, multiply, divide. There's a lot more things to worry about. So RISC was kind of reacting to these difficulties, that these complex instructions were not especially faster, and sometimes were slower, but at least were not especially faster than because of how they were actually being implemented, or what you had to do that at the time. There are other things you could do. You could imagine that a benefit of having this instruction is that maybe you come up with a faster hardware to help you do this, and you could take advantage of that, which my loop couldn't. But that's typically not what was happening. And they observed that these instructions, they're hard to implement, because now I have to write these little library functions in this very constrained language, and I have to test all of it every time I put out a piece of new hardware. In addition, and if I mess up, it's not a software upgrade. It's fix the replace the lookup table piece of hardware. But the bigger change was that the people who designed RISC were making a bet that people would use compilers. They observed that, hey, people don't like writing assembly anymore, and compilers are getting better. So let's start trusting compilers. And let's just assume we're going to make our compilers do more work for us, and we're going to take advantage of that to make the hardware simpler. So the RISC ISAs are doing things which make the compiler and assembly writers' work harder in order to make the processor simpler and not focus on these sort of complex instructions, but focus more on implementing simple instructions really well and exposing what the hardware does quickly in those simple instructions. And so as part of this, they made some choices. So the big one is they have fewer and simpler instructions. So they're going to have something that's easier to test, and they're just going to focus on making those instructions work well. They'll typically have separate instructions to access memory. So one thing which is complicated about something like x86 or VAX's instructions is that if you think of an add, everything could access a register or memory. So they keep things simple by having most instructions only access registers, and we just have dedicated instructions for accessing memory. And this will make our hardware a lot simpler. And because they're doing that, one thing they'll do because of that is they'll have more registers. So one reason to have more registers is if you have to access memory with separate instructions, we want you to do it less. And our hope is that compilers will figure out how to not access memory very often by using these extra registers. Another reason to use more registers is that this is a way we can use the space we save by having simpler instructions. We can just use it to give the programmer more registers with that same amount of hardware that's now easier hardware to design that will still help performance. Another thing is they typically have fixed length instructions. This makes the hardware simpler, and because we have fewer simpler instructions, we aren't as concerned about encoding like really complicated instructions. And we're making a choice here that our programs are going to be bigger, that we're not going to save space. And we're doing that in two ways. So one way is that because we don't have instructions like MatchC, we're going to have more instructions, that the compilers are going to generate more instructions. You know, even if we think of comparing to x86, we have separate instructions to access memory. That means on a RISC machine, we're going to have more instructions to load things to and from memory. And we're also not going to save space by making simple instructions shorter. So like an add instruction that adds two registers probably can be shorter than an instruction that like loads a constant into a register, because the register numbers are shorter than the constants you would load. But we're going to choose to have fixed length to keep things simpler at the cost of longer machine code. And the assumption here is that we'll devote extra effort to making the machine code loading go fast enough, and it's not going to be an issue. But that's a compromise that they deliberately made. Yes?
You're talking about instructions with the same length. Is it kind of like IBCM where they were all like the same number of bits?
So the question is, for fixed length instructions, do I mean they all have the same number of bits? Yes, exactly. Just like IBCM with 16 bits. So these RISC-like instruction sets you can see up here, you know, are like 4 bytes, so 32 bits, or is like a common length. You might see some other ones. Yeah?
Also, didn't it say how there are going to be fewer instructions, but if you look at on that chart,
so
VAX is like less than, that one has 150 compared to some of the other ones.
So your question is, didn't we say we had fewer instructions, and why does VAX only have 150? Yes. So fewer instructions as a trend, not. So there are two issues here. So one is how you count instructions. So all of the VAX 150 instructions support a ridiculously more addressing modes than, like, support more addressing modes than x86 supports. Like more ways of specifying memory addresses. So there were fewer instructions, but all the instructions were much more complicated. and would be, might be separate instructions in other architectures. This is part of the issue where I say approximate number of instructions. Another issue is that many of the previously RISC-like architectures like have evolved over time, and they just keep adding more and more and more instructions. You know, they were originally designed to have a nice simple instruction set, and that's not true anymore as far as count of instructions. But simplicity from the point of like the instructions like do the same sort of thing is probably more true. Yeah?
How does fewer instructions affect like running older software on the RISC processors?
So since the question is how does this affect running older software on RISC processors? So generally, when we have one to port to a different ISA, we need to like recompile, right? It's different assembly language. So we're going to have to write for that, the right assembly language. So if you have something compiled for MIPS, it's compiled for MIPS. If you don't, you can't run into MIPS until you recompile it or unless you simulate it or something like that. Yeah?
You're talking about MIPS and size of instructions. You're talking about
Yeah, so by loops inside single instructions, I mean like lock match string. If you know x86 has instructions that involve rep on x86, which is basically a loop in an instruction. This is not something a RISC architecture would do, most likely. Yeah?
This is slightly like outside, but like you know how you said how you have like recompile on different ISAs, like on different machines?
Yeah.
So like if you created like a Java executable, like a jar file, would that be able to work on like every computer or not?
So the question is, so we have things where for different ISAs we have to recompile, but for something like Java we don't, and the answer is like Java, we have some code which is somehow translating to the ISA we actually have that we have to run it with, right? So when I'm saying we're running on the ISA, I mean we're providing machine code that the hardware understands. For Java, you don't do that. You provide this Java class bytecode, which a program you run, the Java interpreter or just-in-time compiler, uses to actually do what you want. And that program you run is written for the appropriate machine. So you'll have a different program for MIPS versus x86 to run it. Yeah?
So every machine has a single ISA that can be used with it?
So every machine has a single ISA, yes. So, okay. But there might be multiple machines that all implement the same ISA, and that's pretty common, in fact. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, my laptop and desktop have different types of different versions of Intel processors with a different hardware design,
but
they both implement the same ISA. So we got to no loops. Yeah, so we don't have instructions like match C, which do like an arbitrary amount of work. Typically, the notion is that basically you can think of it as RISC instructions are typically designed to be executed basically in the same amount of time for each one. And they actually had a particular hardware design in mind called pipelining, which we'll talk about later, which like strongly suggests like why that would be the case. We also don't have instructions with two memory operands. So part of keeping things simple is that every instruction is going to do one computation or one memory access. It's not going to do more than that. And we have few addressing modes. Our notion is that we don't need to provide all this base index scale stuff that the compiler can figure that out. We don't need to do that work. Okay. So, the general rule with these ISAs is that CISC is making things simpler for assembly writers and more work for the hardware. RISC is making it less work for the hardware. So that's the most important thing to remember is RISC is simpler hardware. The only way that comes at non-intuitive is that yes, RISC has more registers, but the notion is that you have more hardware to have more registers, but that's really simple hardware design. You're just copying and pasting versus adding new instructions. That's much more work. So questions about RISC and CISC? Okay. So something to note is I wrote CISC-like and RISC-like. This is not a hard line. You can't. There's very few instruction sets you can point out and say, this is definitely CISC, this is definitely RISC. Like VAX is definitely CISC, MIPS, original MIPS especially, is definitely RISC, but otherwise you're kind of in a, you're usually in a gray area. It's usually not like a clear dividing line. So there are things which have more of the attributes of RISC and CISC. And we'll see with Y86 that Y86 is in that space. It's in between. And you might say, OK, so we use x86. Also, when I looked at ARM on that table, it had a lot of instructions and does weird things like has shifts in as an addressing mode. Maybe CISC is the winner. But you need to understand that what instruction sets we use doesn't actually have that much to do with what's technically better. It has a lot to do with backwards compatibility, that we want to produce a new chip that's compatible with the old chip. That's what we'll do. This is not usually not a judgment that that's a really good instruction set. We're not using x86 because it's a really good instruction set. We're using x86 because we have x86 software we want to keep running. Or if I'm selling chips, I have x86 chips I want to sell to people who have x86 software. So the choice is more of a social one than a technical one. So we've talked about all these technical factors, but that's not why things are done the way they are. Another thing is that a modern implementation often actually is kind of more RISC-like in internal. So a modern x86 implementation often does something like the microcode idea I talked about for VAX to convert the complex x86 instructions to something more RISC-like. That's often the first step in an x86 processor's implementation. And that sounds like it's really expensive, but usually it doesn't have that much cost because even RISC-like processors have to do a bunch of instruction preprocessing for the very fastest ways of implementing it that we'll talk about much later in the semester. And so you kind of can do this almost for free along with that other preprocessing we'll talk about later in the semester. So any questions on these? Okay, so I guess I also have the point, compilers tend to use RISC-like instructions. Like, compilers aren't actually good at using like a string-in-string instruction. Like, they're not going to do that anyways. So, like, what compilers generate is closer to like what RISC machines support. Question?
So modern CISC processors are kind of VAX in that they break down more complex instructions into smaller ones?
So modern CISC processors are kind of like VAX and they break down complex instructions into smaller ones? Yes, that is a common part of the implementation. There are other things going on, of course. There's also more than one way to implement a modern x86 processor. Yeah?
Is that called a lookup table applied to microcode? Is that free?
No. So as I said, they have to do instruction preprocessing anyways, so it's not as expensive as it could be. And you can do it in parallel with other work, which is another way it's not so expensive. But it's not free. And probably the more notable question is that there's suspicion that like you basically pay a non-trivial power cost. It's not clear like what the minimum you can get is. But like if you had to guess reasons why x86 had trouble going into the mobile space, it might be that it's hard to make these implementations have low power relative to something like ARM, which has a simpler encoding that's closer to what your RISC backend would use. Okay, so now that we've talked about ISAs, let's talk about Y8664, which is the instruction set we'll be using for our assignments semester. So it's a subset of x86. It omits most of those instructions to make things simpler. And so we just need to worry about this subset. And you know most of these instructions. There's a few that probably aren't familiar to you, and a few which have been renamed as I've noted here. So first, we have JCC and CMOVECC. The CC stands for something like equals, less than, etc. So something based on the condition codes, that's why I use CC. So let's first talk about MoveQ, which as I noted is renamed. And it's renamed into four different instructions. The idea is we're going to have a different name depending on the type of the thing being moved from and to. And because this is designed by our textbook authors with AT&T syntax in mind, the name is source then destination, with a letter specifying the type of the source and the type of the destination. The source starts with an I for an immediate, which is the same as a constant. So for example, in add $1rex, this $1 is an immediate. An immediate means a value in the instruction. So in the machine code, this is going, that number one is going to appear inside the instruction itself. And that's an immediate. We also have a register or a value in memory. And we have this for all the source and destination. So we have 9 possibilities. So moving into an immediate, moving into a constant doesn't make any sense. So those instructions don't exist. So that's why we don't have II move Q, RI move Q, MI move Q. You can't move into a constant, so we don't do it. So then we have 2 others we omit. So we don't implement immediate to memory move or memory to memory move. And this is just a choice. Yes, these are sensible instructions where it's clear what they would do, but we have decided, our textbook authors, that to keep the hardware simpler, we're not going to have them. Okay, so questions about these forms of move? Yeah.
Yeah, for the immediate, like, where did the constants come from? Because, like, in IBCM, we didn't have constants.
So the question is, where do the constants come from? This will be in the machine code of the instruction, which we'll see later. So other questions about move? Yeah.
What are the implications on the arrays?
What?
Being able to move into like memory, what are the implications of arrays?
What about locations in arrays?
So if you can't like move an immediate to a memory address, how are you able to use like arrays?
So the question is, I can't move an immediate to a memory address. How do I like load a value, a constant, into a memory address? Well, first you load it from an immediate into a register, and then you load it from a register into memory. So you can still do everything. You can still do memory to memory moves and immediate to memory moves, but you need 2 instructions, not 1. And you need to have a spare register to do it. Other questions? Okay, so then we have this CMoveCC. So this is an instruction, set of instructions that exist in x86, but you may not have seen. So this is a conditional move. So it's like a move instruction, but instead of moving all the time, it only moves if the condition codes match a certain condition. So for example, CMove if greater than, CMoveG, REX to RBX, is the same as skip this instruction if less than is true. So jump less than to skip over a move, otherwise move. And this happens to be pretty easy to implement in hardware with the implementation techniques we'll talk about later, which is why our textbook authors chose it. Keep it. Okay, so questions on this? Should we move? Okay, so then we have HALT. So there's an x86-64 instruction called HLT, which you probably haven't seen because it only works in the operating system. And it stops the processor until something happens. On our setup, it's going to stop the processor when we're simulating it to tell us the simulation's done. If we don't have this, like, it's going to keep running instructions because that's what it does. So this is what we're going to have. So we have a way to stop it. Okay. So that's our the instructions. So let's talk a bit about what the operands for the instructions can be, because this is going to be different than what we're used to in x86, and generally simpler. So this is the way you can specify memory addresses. You can specify an offset. If you omit the offset, it means zero. And a base register. This is the only form that is supported. An offset, which if you omitted it's zero, and a base register, so you cannot do any of the other fun versions we know from x86 of base plus index, or index times scale, or base plus index times scale. They're all not supported in y86, not instructions that exist. Okay, so another thing is that I said that we have these memory move instructions. So we mentioned that RISC architecture is like having separate instructions for accessing memory. y86 follows that part of the RISC philosophy. So the move instructions can access memory, everything else can't. So this add instruction doesn't exist. So what can I do instead? I want to do this add in y86, how do I do it? Okay, so we have to move memory into a register. And what would that look like? Yeah, what would the assembly look like?
MR move Q, yeah. The memory address in Q.
Okay, which happens to be 10R11.
Yeah, and then move that into R12.
So R12 is what we want to add to.
Okay.
So we don't want to move into that because we'll overwrite it before we add to it.
Just any other empty register.
Yeah. So we'll have to we'll have to choose an empty register, and this is like, hope we don't need this for something else. So we'll use an extra register. Move into it, and then we'll add the value we move into that register into R12. Yeah?
How is the C and the C++ calling convention, is it at all affected by this, or do those...
The question is, does this change the C and C++ calling convention? No. We just care about what registers things are in, we can still access those registers. We have to obey the rules when we're using temporary registers, of course. So I might need to push and pop things based on that, but it doesn't affect the calling convention. Okay, questions on this? Okay. So let's say this example. How can I do this in y86? So here I'm doing 10 plus R11 times 8 as the memory address, adding that to R12. How can I do that in y86? Yeah.
So we start by multiplying R11 by 8.
Okay, so your steps are multiply R11 by 8. So how do we do that?
Is there not a
Unfortunately, there is not.
Okay, so we could add 8 times.
So we can add, yeah.
Oh, we can do a shift. Do we have a shift instruction?
Sadly, we do not.
Okay. Well,
so you can add 8 times. Okay, so that's... So add...
Oh, but we have to add it to itself. Is that even allowed?
Yeah. That's a real instruction. So
do it 8 times, we do it 2, 3 times.
Do it 3 times, yeah. So observation, add R11 plus R11 gives us 2 times R11. R11 plus R11 again gives us 2 times R11. This is 2 R11. So we end up with this. Or you could add 8 times starting with 0 in a different register be another valid solution. So we can still do everything. Some things that we did in x86, some things are just more complicated, but it's still possible. And yes, you would have expected a multiply instruction or a shift instruction, we just don't have one. Okay, so that's on accessing memory. So another note is constants. I remove Q is the only instruction which takes a constant that isn't an address. So this means that you want to add 1 to R12, you can't do that as one instruction. You need two instructions and an extra register. So like load 1 into your register, then add that register to R12. So all these rules together mean that YAD664 only allows one kind of operand for every instruction. And this is why we renamed move into four different names. So once we see the name of the move, we know exactly what the kind of operands are. There's only one possibility. We don't have maybe a constant, maybe something else. So you just look at the instruction name. You know exactly what the operands are. You just need to fill in the blanks. And that will be important later on when we talk about encodings. Okay. So then we have condition codes. So we saw that we had conditional move instructions use condition codes in our conditional jumps. So as I alluded to when we talked about condition codes earlier, in this class we're only going to be concerned about ZF and SF. Our textbook talks about OF. We're going to ignore it to simplify assignments, and we're also going to ignore CF. In YAD664, these are only set by add, subtract, and an XOR. Everything else doesn't change the condition codes. And these are used by instructions like conditional jump and conditional move. And we only support less than equal, not equal, greater than equal, and greater than. Everything else, like jump above equal, jump signed, all those things you saw in x86, we don't have. We only have these. And this table might be handy later on when you have to implement these and translate the condition codes into a decision about whether there's a jump or not. Yeah?
Can you say we have to implement these? Are we doing it in C?
Are we doing it? So the question is, what are you implementing these in? You're going to implement this in HCL. So note about conditionals. If you saw my list of instructions that set condition codes, you may notice that comp and test aren't on the list. They aren't on the list because they aren't YAD6 instructions. So instead, you're going to use normal arithmetic. If you want to do a conditional jump, you do a subtract probably to do your comparison because there's no compare instruction. And this means, yes, you need to worry about changing a register that you might not care about changing. But you can deal with that by moving if you need to, moving the value into a spare register if that's needed. Okay, questions about this? So we can still do all our comparisons, we just need an extra register, which was a common theme here, that all these simplifications make us need extra registers. And this gives you an idea about one of the reasons why RISC added registers, you know, because they kind of gloss over what the simplifications do to make code more complicated by making those extra registers just there. Okay, so we also have push and pop. They work the same as in x86, which you should already know, but this slide has review if you want a refresher, because it is easy to forget whether the value pushed is where the stack pointer is or not. The answer is we pop the value that the stack pointer points to, we push the address below that. And call and return work as in x86. So call pushes the next machine code address onto the stack and jumps, just like a jump. And return pops an address from the stack and jumps to it. Okay, so questions about these? And our plan is that you're not going to implement push, pop, call, or return when we have you do the processor implementation, but they're in our textbook and they wouldn't be hard to implement, just to save some time.
Yeah.
so we have these instructions. We talked about what type of operands they take. Let's talk about what state we're going to need to keep track of in our implementation. So we have our registers, and we're only going to have 15 of them. We're going to get rid of R15, and we'll see why when we talk about encoding. We just wanted to make the encoding a little simpler to deal with by getting rid of it. We have zero flag and the sign flag to keep track of. We have the program counter, which we need to keep track of, but I didn't mention it before except as part of call and return. We have values in memory, so we have a memory that contains data. And we have one other piece of information our processor is going to track, and that's something our textbook calls stat, which is what we're going to use to indicate whether we're halted or not, and what our simulation is going to check to know, should I keep simulating or not? So questions about this? So something to note is that why, as I mentioned earlier, YD6 kind of is in between RISC and CISC. We have some RISC things that YD6 definitely does. It definitely has separate instructions to access memory. All our instructions definitely don't do any sort of loops or anything like that. They all access memory at most once. They don't have two memory operands. And they have few addressing modes. There's like one way of specifying the operands for everything, and there's a small number of possible types of operands in total. We have registers, we have memory locations as base plus offset, and we have constants and links, and that's it. We kind of have fewer simpler instructions, but some of our instructions aren't that simple, like call, push, pop, aren't as simple. We have more registers relative to like real CISC machines, so kind of, but like 16, 15 isn't a huge number of registers. It's maybe less than a typical RISC system, and we definitely don't have fixed length instructions. So let's talk about our instruction format next. We're kind of in the middle, so we have some RISC attributes, we kind of have some others, and we definitely don't have fixed length instructions. So this is what our instruction format looks like. So this table shows the bytes of the instruction. So what this, and this shows you the two nibbles as hexadecimal. So a NOP is encoded as the byte 0x10. If the NOP is followed by a halt, this means we'll have 0x10 as a byte in memory, followed by 0x00. This is NOP followed by halt in memory will look like that. That makes sense. And to figure out where an instruction is, you have to look at how big it is, where the next instruction is, you have to look at how big it is in this table by finding the row that matches. And if it doesn't match, it's an error. If it doesn't match any of the rows. And we also have some fill in the blanks. So for example, for this rrmoveq/cmoveCC column, we have this fill in the blank of CC, and we have some other ones, and I'll talk about those next. So what are these CC fields? So this is going to be replaced by a nibble, 4 bits, according to this table. So we have LE, LE, NE, GE, G for CMove, LE, or jump LE. We put that in that space to form our instruction. So that's straightforward. We have this special case of 0, which I labeled as always. So we use the same form to represent rrmoveq as cmove. So we think rrmoveq, rrmove, register to register move, that's not conditional. It's just a conditional move that always happens. And we represent that by encoding it just like a conditional move, but we have 0 in this CC field to indicate what condition codes it cares about, which is 0 for none of them. And the same is true for an unconditional jump. So JLE will be encoded by a 7 followed by a 2 for, sorry, followed by 1 for LE. A jump is going to be encoded by a 7 followed by a 0 for always jump, no matter what the condition codes are. So questions about that encoding? So this is how, so we have these related instructions where notably we can look at the top nibble of the first byte to figure out the general category, and we have this more specific information about what the instruction is, in this case, what kind of condition codes it cares about, if any. But they're otherwise the same. We also have this second nibble to distinguish between our different arithmetic instructions. So I have this column labeled OPQ, and that represents all the arithmetic operations. So it's an add, subtract, and or XOR, depending on what the next nibble is. And if it's not on this list, it's invalid. And these instructions are all similar. They all do a computation inside the condition codes, and they look the same as far as what the arguments are. So we have them share most of their machine code. And we just distinguish them by this one set of four bits. Questions? Okay. So next we have some fields that represent registers. And we have just a table mapping the registers to the values we put in there. We have no R15. Instead, we use the value 15 to represent this instruction doesn't take a register in that slot. So for example, for the push and pop instructions, they only take one register. So we use 15 to fill in the second register slot, which is going to hopefully simplify our implementation a little bit by allowing us to not have to have a special case for push and pop versus the instructions which take two registers. That's at least probably the intention of the textbook authors in doing that. Okay, so questions on wrapping? Okay, so we also have immediates. So I'll use immediate to refer to any constant that's part of the machine code for an instruction. So we have our most obvious immediate is the constant V that appears in the IRMOVEQ instructions, the value there. We also have the immediate of the offset that appears in our memory accessing instructions, and the labels passed to jump and call, which the immediate is the address the label ends up being. And these are stored as 8 bytes, always 8 bytes, in little endian order. So we have them for our moves. Our moves have an immediate, which is either an offset for a memory address or the constant to load. And we have them for our conditional jump and call, which is the address to go to. Okay, so any questions? Yes. Okay, so that's our encoding, and next time we'll go through some complete examples, but let's start out by taking this function here. So here's my add1 function. I have an x86 64 version. So this is not valid y86 64, if only because there's move is split into something else. So how did I convert this into y86 64? So you want me to add one to RDI. So that's a reasonable idea, except remember that we can't take him at constant. Okay, so you want to IR move. Okay, so your idea is IR move into one into what?
My guess is to move 1 into RAX and add RDI.
Okay, so your idea is move 1 into RAX and add RDI into it. So that is one way of implementing this, and that's what I had. There's other ways, like a more direct translation might be to move RDI to RAX, and as you say, move 1 to a random register. And then add that, this would be RCX, add that register to RAX. Be a more direct translation work. Okay, and that's where I'll leave off. Next time we'll talk about, okay, we have Y86 assembly, how do we encode it? Just some practice with that.